What up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and it's always a joy, and it does my heart good to know that you're listening because you do that download thing that you do so well. You know where to find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast on. Don't forget to do the download thing. Also, wear the mask. You know how I feel about that. Don't be stupid. Don't get punked. Wear the mask. Well, this has been a hell. Ryan just put on his mask.
I got my mask, baby.
This would be a hell of a conversation, folks, because I got lucky this week. We'll talk about that later.
Oh, that sounds like a personal thing.
Yeah, it's a kind of a personal issue, but I did get lucky this week because we have stepping up in the house, Brian Karam.
Everybody gets it wrong, even my
mom.
You
know, no, Brian, get this. I was practicing your name before you called it, and I was saying Karam. I was getting it
there
right.
You go.
And of course, as soon as I get on the air, I F it up. Anyway, Brian Karam is an award-winning journalist, author, speaker, and recognized defender of the First Amendment. He currently serves as a political analyst for CNN and is the senior White House correspondent for Playboy. Now, that's what I'm talking about, yeah. Right?
That's the interview.
That's the interview I want to do.
There you go.
But Brian has worked in both newspaper and television as an investigative journalist covering politics, crime, refugee issues, and state and local news. His work experience includes America's Most Wanted, People Magazine, Fox News, NBC News, and the Courier Journal, among others. Yes, he has the bona fides to care about the First Amendment. He just recently received a number of awards, most recently the Peringer Award, and the Freedom of the Press Award, and was recently nominated as Journalist of the Year by the Los Angeles Press Club. Mr. Karam is the author of 7 books, a member of the White House Press Corps, which if you have been watching, you know who I'm talking about, right? And is the National Press Club and serves as president of the MDDC Press Association. He is also the host of the podcast, Just Ask the Question, which Amen. Launched in 2018. Brian, welcome to the podcast, bro.
I'm glad to be here.
It's good having you, man. It really is. And all right, I don't even know where to begin because, brother, you know, it's hysterical because you were doing the appropriate thing, the mask on, social distancing. The president calls on you.
Yeah, I was surprised about that.
I know you were surprised about that, given your history in that room with the White House generally and the president specifically. But folks, here's the headline that was on the front page of Deadline. It said, Donald Trump gave an answer to Playboy's Brian Karam and triggered new fears of an election crisis. And Brian is quoted as saying, nobody was more surprised to me. Yeah, folks, this is the same Brian who asked the question about whether or not he would go peacefully if he loses. In other words, would he go through the process of a peaceful transition of power? And the president came back with what is now an infamous response in the 2 days since it occurred that, we'll just do away with, if we just do away with the ballots, I don't have to worry about that. Brian, what the hell was going on, man?
I don't know. I was, you have to understand, I was already in shock that he had called me.
Well, you know what it was? It was the mask. He didn't realize who you were with the mask on.
I think he also likes the fight. He knows that he called me and a couple other people, he's going to get it. But nonetheless, I hadn't been in front of him since like June out in the Rose Garden. Because of the COVID virus, there's a limited number of people that can be in the room. I'm not in the pool. But so on days where I'm there, and I'm only there like once a week because of COVID,
right.
I end up standing in the back of the room shouting my questions because they won't call on me. And that hacks them off. I heard that the chief of staff actually complained to the White House Correspondents Association and others that I should be punished because I'm breaching protocol. I guess they weren't there in the 80s when Sam Donaldson was yelling at right and left, and they had no idea what the press corps is about. But on Wednesday, it was really funny. I assumed I was just going to be standing in the back with OAN like I usually am when I'm there. And an hour before, an hour before this press conference, I was out on the north lawn in the driveway tossing football with a television cameraman. I figured, well, I'm not going to get in. So I walked in, and they gave the 2-minute warning, and there was an empty seat in the back. And I said, well, I'm going to take it. And so I sat down and I listened to him talk, and I raised my hand, and damned if he didn't call.
Called on
the first question right out of the bat, the gate. And so that question had been on everyone's mind, right, more or less for weeks, months. I mean, what's Trump going to do if he loses? I mean, that's always, because he's setting it up. He's already screaming fraud when we haven't even had the election yet.
Right.
So, what's he trying to set up? What's his exit strategy if he loses? And there had been an Atlantic article on it that morning that I had read. And I thought that it was either, I had two questions in mind. I was going to either ask that one or the question about Russia. Does he owe money to oligarchs, bankers, or to someone next to Putin because he won't, take sanctions against Russia? So it was one of those two questions that I was jostling in my mind. But I thought, well, one is a bait question. I'm going to, I know what he's going to say about Russia. No one's been tougher on Russia than him. And so why waste my time
with
him on that? The other thing is I've learned in 4 years of covering this guy that you really have to be blunt and succinct with your questions. With most politicians, I can say, for example, Mr. Steele, in 1983, this happened, and then in 87, that happened. You took a stance here, you took a stance there. Now, why are you doing this today? And reasonable people will go, oh, okay, well, here's, but you can't do that with Donald.
Right.
with Trump.
Unless, of course, you're Lindsey Graham.
Well, even then, you don't want to hear it. He'll interrupt anybody. And the thing is you can't ask his minions a question about policy because he throws them under the bus every day.
Yeah.
So if they say something and he doesn't agree with it, he doesn't care. He'll come out and say whatever he wants. So why waste it with Kayleigh McEnany or out on the lawn with Kudlow or Meadows or anyone else? Just go to the source. And so I figured that I could put that question succinctly in 15 words or less. Will you, commit to a peaceful transfer of power, win, lose, or draw?
Right.
We all know that the only one that matters is a lose. But you give him the option. That way it doesn't seem.
Look, he likes options. Give him options.
Yeah, so I hit him with that one. And when he said, maybe, wait a minute, there's already riots. Don't you want some peace here?
I noticed that because you went right to, and what I loved about what you did, and this is not blowing smoke because you're on the podcast, because it is good journalism. You listened to what he said, and you went, wait a minute, okay, maybe you didn't understand the question, and maybe you don't understand what's going on outside your window, but there are riots on the street.
Right.
there are people who are anxious about this election. And your response to my question again is what?
Yeah. Or as my dad would say, what the? I had that WTF moment. And
you did. I could tell. Right.
And so he started talking about the ballots. And I go, look, I understand that. But I don't agree with it. But I understand his argument about it. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, is there going to be a peaceful transfer of power? And when he wouldn't commit to it, I was like looking around the room going, hey, does anybody else hear me?
am I the only one hearing this? But it was the precise imprecision of what he said that I found the most striking. And by that, I mean, he was imprecise in that he was kind of all over the map. And just kind of like, well, the trend, he's trying to dance between transition and no transition. Right. But the two key pieces, which were the anchors, was, well, we just get rid of those ballots.
Yes.
And there will be no transition.
Yeah. When I heard that, yeah, I was like, what? You know, yeah, that's when I thought I was having an LSD flashback.
There you go.
It was like, I did not hear that from the president.
You were like, no, this is not covering the mansion, the Playboy mansion anymore. Well, this is not covering that anymore.
What was funny is some of his supporters are going, well, you never asked that of any other president. And I said, well, I never had to.
Right, right, right.
It's always been an assumption. I mean, and Mitch McConnell even said, hey, look, it's going to be peaceful like it has been since 1792.
But do you believe him?
No.
Yeah. There's nothing that comes out of any Republican's mouth at this point that's worth believing to the American people.
Only the Republicans who are not in Trump's.
That's it.
Because the Republican Party that I grew up respecting and knowing doesn't really exist under Trump. Yeah.
It's under the heel of the man. And every time someone tries to push up against that heel, to squeeze out from under it, he just comes down harder. And that moment, and I love the way you share that response to people, is like, well, yeah, I never had to. And it begs the question, why would you ever ask that question? Because that's not been part of the American narrative since its founding.
Right.
That a president of the United States would be inclined to want to stick around. And the standard bearer of that was George Washington himself, when the country clamored for him to stay on for as long as he wanted. He understood the responsibility of the office well enough to say, no, I've served my time. This president looks at it and go, no, I'm just warming up.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you cover that? How you are part of a handful, and because again, folks, this is the same Brian Karam who got kicked out of the press room. What was it? About 3-4 weeks ago, when you weren't supposed to come in, and you saw a seat, and you were like, okay, well, I'm just going to go sit down over here, because you weren't supposed to. I don't think you were scheduled to be in the room, but you said that they were violating their own rules.
Well, I stayed that day. They didn't kick me out that day. Because right now I have a court order. They can't. I sued the president of the United States. I never thought that I'd see my name on a styling in court that said Brian Karam versus Donald Trump. And the president of the United States. If you had told me that at any point in time in my life, prior to the time that it occurred, right, I would have laughed and thought you a fool.
Yeah.
But there it is. And that was because of what happened a year ago in the Rose Garden, when he had his conservative social media people there, and they went, you know, kind of nuts. And I fired back on them. And, you know, what's amazing about this president is, I mean, I have had moments with him. He's told me to sit down. He's called me a loudmouth. I got into it with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I got into it with his first one, Sean Spicer. The third one, Stephanie Grisham, was the one who rejected my, or who tried to kick me out with, mm-hmm, you know, and revoke my press pass. And that's still in court. They have appealed it. And if he is reelected, chances are he wants an en banc hearing now. The Court of Appeals has ruled unanimously in my favor. And now he wants, you know, every judge on the Court of Appeals to look at it en banc. If he loses that, his only other recourse is the Supreme Court. And so
good luck with that.
Yeah. Right. So he's trying to stack the deck. He doesn't want reporters. He calls us fake news. He gets mad at us. And when we don't write things that he likes, and he's even admitted it. And so that's where we're at with him. And
how do you as a journalist, I mean, you look, your bona fides are unquestionable. I mean, you've been in the service. Right. You've been in the service of journalism for a while and have covered many presidents and many politicians. How is this, not even how is it different? Because we know it is.
Right.
How is it made more difficult? It's not just being kicked out of the room or having your press pass suspended. And it's got to be more than that. It's got to be something more than that as a journalist who takes journalism seriously and takes the work you do seriously. How is that for you, and what is that environment like? And I do have a follow-up on that that's sure. going to be a little bit picky with respect to your brethren and sister.
Oh, we can go after that too. The difference is, look, hate mail I've always gotten. And when I first met Helen Thomas, she said, look, if you're looking for friends, don't be a journalist. She's the reason why I named my podcast, by the way, Just Ask the Question. She said, look, it's it's not important that they answer it, and it's not important what their answer is. It's only important that you ask the question and it's right. heard, and that way they cannot deny that the issue has been brought before them. So the hate mail has always been around. It's the death threats, the threats to, you know, to my grandchild that, you know, is your child, your grandchild should die. I'm looking for you. You ever come here, I'll kill you, that kind of stuff. But it's, and even that stuff is at the end of the day, while sobering, is
right.
to actually do the job. The biggest roadblock to doing the job now is the president of the United States himself, who from day one has said that I'm an enemy of the people and that we're fake media. We never heard those terms prior to him, but his minions have taken it up as a chant, and he can, and the coronavirus has effectively helped him keep the press at bay. So there's only 14 people in that press room instead of 100, you know, so we can't do our job effectively.
Right.
And the suppression of free speech under this president, while he continues to advocate for free speech.
Right.
Is frustrating beyond belief. As
but he doesn't really advocate for free speech. It's like
as
most things. Right. He says the words, but they have little to no meaning at all.
Is faithful.
Right. So on that point, though, a couple of things. One, when you talk about the fake news and the enemy of the people, how did the press allow that to stick?
Because there's a problem. There's a problem in the press. There are multiple reasons for the problems in the press. One could go back to Nixon and Roger Ailes as the root cause. Donald Trump isn't the cause. He's
right.
And it was Nixon wanting to get rid of press that didn't like him. It was Roger Ailes who, by the way, helped, you know, Ronald Reagan's greatest legacy to the United States is Mitch McConnell. In 1984, in his reelection bid, the Republican Party only gained one house in the Senate, one seat in the Senate, and that was Mitch McConnell.
That's right.
And he ran and won on a very duplicitous commercial that got him in when no one thought he could. Dee Huddleston was considered like the Kentucky Kennedy.
I remember that. I remember, yeah. He had a
94% attendance rate.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell, with the help of Roger Ailes, ran a commercial of three hunters. This is typical for Kentucky. You know, three hunters with coon hounds in the woods going, ur, and they're running. They're going, where's Dee Huddleston?
Remember that commercial.
And
yes.
That Mitch McConnell was behind by 20 points in the rate in the polling until that commercial. That was Roger Ailes' baby. The people who put together that ad said they never met anyone more malleable than Mitch McConnell, who, by the way, at the time was the chief executive of Jefferson County in Kentucky, was considered a moderate.
Had
a civil rights commission that he had people chair, and a women's right commission. He ditched all of that to go to Reagan and to the far right where the money was. And so and after that, Reagan, when he got into office, the first thing he did with Roger Ailes was to get rid of the ownership rules in media. So
that's how Fox came into being.
That's how every, and then they got rid of the fairness doctrine.
The fairness doctrine,
and
yeah.
So media companies started buying each other up. And today, while there's twice the number of people on this planet than on the day that I was born, there's half the number of reporters. We went from 80% of what you see, read, or hear being owned by 20 some odd companies to 90% of what you see, read, or hear being owned by six. Mm-hmm. And all of that began, that's the root cause. And so the immediate cause of the problems in the press and why we don't push back and why we allowed it to happen is because we are now cost efficient.
Yes, you are.
So the people, when I first walked in, and there's a great story, the first day I walked into the White House, I was introduced to Helen. Helen knew my great-grandfather and took me home to her house because my great-grandfather had helped her family immigrate to the United States.
Wow.
So she took me home and made me to her house and made me a great Lebanese dinner. And she introduced me. I'd already known Sam Donaldson, but she was talking to Sam, and Sam said, "You listen to her. She knows what she's doing. And then you listen to me, and I'll tell you how to be heard." And then her and Sam got into it, and Sam said something like, "Hey, Helen, it's okay to have an unexpressed thought." And Helen said, "Sam, when it comes to you, I have a lot of unexpressed thoughts." But the thing that they said that stuck with me was in that first row in the briefing room was about 250 years of experience. And of course, Sam was the one who said, and 200 of it is with Helen, which prompted me.
right, exactly.
But today there's the that kind of institutional memory is missing.
Yeah.
And you have younger and younger people with less and less experience. And we have come to believe that our job is not to push back, like, you know, Donaldson and you name it back in the day would push.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I remember the first day I went there, Helen and Tom were beating on Larry Speak's office and upper press demanding that he come out and talk to us. If I did that today, I'd be arrested, or yeah, they would try to have me arrested.
Right.
So the press has become more tepid and more tame. And it was Donaldson and it was even Dan Rather who noted that in the 90s, the beginning of the decline.
But how do you, given your not just your experience, but the way you've approached this White House, once you sized it up and you had an assessment of, okay, I see how they're going to play this game.
Right.
You adapt it. You're like, okay, you think you're going to cut me off over here? I got to move to get over there. Oh, you think you got that block? No, I know where the basement is. I'm going to start there and come up, right? So you seem to, which is why you have been in the news and why you're headlining on this particular story, because you have emerged as one of the few. My friend and colleague, April Ryan, being another.
I love April. I call her my little sister.
Yeah, I mean, she's my sister, absolutely. Who would like, excuse me, no. Sarah, that's just wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Kaylee, no. Where'd that come from?
April ain't playing.
No, April's not playing. So, but you literally, Brian, can count on one hand the number of reporters who actually stand their ground as journalists, as White House correspondents, when these briefings take place. That's one. Two, the lack of, again, I'm talking to you as someone, as an observer of the media in these moments. So the number two is the lack of reinforcement. Classic case, when you asked your question of the president, and the president does that thing where he knows he's been caught and he wants to get out of it, and so he dismisses the question and the reporter, usually with some bromide or some bullshit that don't make any sense to nobody but him, and even then I question if it does, right? The next question should be, oh, well, Mr. President, just to follow up on Brian's question.
We don't do that much.
Why? Would you not? Why can't you? What do you mean? What the hell's up with that? Why don't you guys reinforce each other? Because let me tell you, sitting out in television land watching this, We're jumping through our television screen.
Standing in that room, I'm jumping through. Hey, that's you know. Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One, and Joe Lockhart, former press secretary, right. Said he that was when he got most afraid being up there, or more most concerned was when reporters started, as he called it, triangulating and going, hey, what about, wait a minute, you said that, and he goes, and then his dance was,
right, right.
We don't do that. And the reason why we don't do it now is because there's only 14 people in the room. And so on most days, a press briefing with Kaylee is going to be 10 minutes of her telling us we suck and the Democrats suck and Donald Trump is, you know, Jesus incarnate.
Right.
And maybe she'll show a video of Nancy Pelosi getting a haircut, for what reason, we don't know. And then she'll open it up to questions, and she's going to take a Fox question. She's going to take a Steve Holland question from Reuters, and then she's going to take someone
an own question. That...
And then the OAN question. Right. And she's going to make another five-minute statement, drop the mic, and get out of there. With so much to cover, and let's put it bluntly, with so many screw-ups by the president on any given day, there's so many issues to cover, you can't really, with 14 people and limited time, 20 to 25 minutes, and 15 of those minutes are taken up with Kaylee's statements and you know, her video.
Her audio drama, video. Right.
Yeah, you can't do that. That's why they think, you know, some of the supporters go, well, Kaylee's really effective. No, she's not. She's, when that one day, when all 14, there was one day about 2 weeks ago when he screwed the pooch and stepped on his own 2 feet about the vets.
Right.
And he pissed off everybody. Everyone in that room, it was one of the nicest, brightest days. That was the one issue on the one day, and Kaylee could not handle it. She walked out because everybody followed up on everyone else. But here's the real reason is, all right, like you mentioned, April Ryan. I'll give you a list of people that used to be in the room and do it. April Ryan, Steve Portnoy, John Carl, Weijang, anyone from NBC.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, Hallie's famous for, yeah.
Alexander.
Right.
Amon Jeffers.
Right.
Brian Karam, Jim Acosta, Caitlin Collins. All of them would be in that room at the same time, and if you started some stuff, one of us was going to,
right,
and we wouldn't bother to raise our hands because we knew how that goes. We say, hey, wait a minute. You said, like the day when I caught Sean Spicer saying, you know, it, you know, that at least Hitler never killed his own people. I said, Sean, he gassed the Jews. And he goes, oh, yeah, right, right. Sorry about that. And that's the only time in 4 years anyone in that briefing room ever apologized. So I'll give Sean Spicer that. He came out after he screwed that up and apologized for it.
Right.
It's never happened since then, and they've made far more egregious mistakes.
And Sean's no longer there because he apologized. Not simply for that single issue, but in combination, yeah. The president didn't like his suits, and, well, you know.
And that's why we have the problem. That's why
important,
you don't get pushed
important stuff like that. All right, well, look, we're going to take a quick break because this brother, we got more to throw down with Brian.
We're ready.
But we'll do that after this quick break for some folks who really like me. They really, really do. And we'll be back with more with Brian Karam right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, it's still me. I ain't going anywhere. And we're having a great conversation, as I mentioned, with Brian Karam, who is the award-winning journalist, White House correspondent, author, speaker, and the host of his own podcast, Just Ask the Question. So, Brian, we were talking about your infamy. and... This week with the question, and that's what it's going to become, I think, in the annals of this moment in this period. When historians look back on it, there are going to be three probably really revealing moments. One will be the president's revelations about how he feels about our men and women in uniform.
Yep.
How he really feels. Two will be what, ironically enough, are going to be known as the Woodward tapes.
Yep.
from the 18 hours of interviews that he did, that the president did. And three, the question about fair a fair election and peaceful transition of power. You wrote a piece back that was actually out yesterday regarding where this country is right now on the heels of the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And the piece entitled An Empty Seat and an Unhealthy Republic. In it, you say, and this was you can find it, folks, at playboy.com, because Brian writes for Playboy. Wink, wink, nod, nod.
And the excuse people give for buying the magazine.
Exactly. And he reads all the articles he writes. So, but in this one piece, you note, the United States is now a country dominated by the tyranny of the minority. We are not a democracy. We're not a republic. Our government is run by aging, rich, white overseers who have a stranglehold on the needs of the many to please the wealthy few. To hell with the rest of us. For the GOP, might makes right. It is short-sighted. It is ignorant. It is arrogant. I ascribe to those words. And it's unfortunate. I mean, one of the great pains for me in the last 3 years, last 5 years, has been watching my party slip into a coma. Comatose on what this nation is and what it represents, comatose on the needs of the American people, comatose on what we were just talking about, freedom of the press. Comatose now on the transition of power, the election itself, watching the party stand by as the president threatens the kind of upheaval that he has in mind and having them say nothing. In your estimation and your coverage of the political environment, how did that happen? You make an interesting point, which I agree with. Donald Trump is not the cause. He is the symptom. He's an expression. I call him the avatar of a lot of pissed off Americans. What are they pissed off about in your estimation? And why do they cling so desperately through this cult of personality, if you will, to Donald Trump?
That's a good question. And there are multiple reasons why people like Donald Trump and what they're pissed off about. There are some angry white people who are pissed off that they may have to actually share civil rights
with everybody else.
With everybody else. And they think somehow that diminishes them.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Yeah, I'm special. You know, yeah, and right. No, we're all, you know, the same. And then they get upset with Black Lives Matter. They're trying to say Black Lives Matter and White Lives. No. What they're saying is you don't think Black Lives Matter. And they do.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I come from a multiracial family background and multi-ethnic family background, as does many people, as do many people in the United States. I'm hardly unique. And there are friends and family of mine that are ardent Trump supporters, and they're pissed off because they think the left left them behind.
Right.
And they're looking for someone, when they say drain the swamp, look, we all know there's problems with the Democratic and Republican Party. To be blunt, you know, the bar is so lowered for this 2020 election that the guy that we're trying to get in office is merely one who shows empathy for someone else. That shouldn't be the bar to jump over. That should be like the ground floor.
That should be like drinking water.
Yeah.
Right.
We've got two aging
important and necessary.
Yeah, we have two aging septuagenarians with bladder control problems running for the highest office in the land, and I got to choose which one's going to treat me like a human being. That's what it boils down to.
You just summed up the 2020 election.
And so there are people, and then there are rich people who are scared. You know, they want it.
Yeah.
Under in the 50s, you know, we created income. We created jobs because there was less distance between the rich and the poor. Today, the real fight are between the haves and the have-nots.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're keeping the rest of us fighting race problems and sex problems and all everything else they can invent to keep us from noticing the fact that they're running away with more and more of the pie and we're left with less and less. Not to say that all those other problems aren't real. I'm saying that when you're rich and you're powerful, you can manipulate other problems to hide what you're doing. And so those people support Donald Trump. And then there are people who just hate. They have it and they don't understand government and they have it in their heart. And it's okay to hate me. I'm not asking you to love me. You can't act on the hate.
Right.
And that's the difference. And he's empowering those people. Those people who have been marginalized for years on the far right? And he's empowered them. And so these are all the kids who got a lot of wedgies when they were kids,
yeah.
Always picked last for kickball and you know, always had, you know, and wanted to be a bully. And now they're getting a chance to be, and you have to do, you know, my dad taught me, he said the only way to treat a bully is to stand up to the bully.
Right.
I agree with that. So there are multiple reasons, but it all boils down to, I don't feel good. Not fair.
So yeah, you know, I identify with that. I get it. I see exactly what you're saying, and that's been my assessment, having, you know, been on the wall, having the watch during the time of the emergence of the Tea Party, and then even noting.
Oh, they're scary folk.
Well, but here, this is the interesting part of it. The Tea Party of 2009, 2010 are not the same folks who were there in 2012, and they certainly aren't the folks who were there in 2016.
No, the Tea Party is far left in the Republican Party today.
Yes.
The only way to win in the Republican Party is to go farther right than the guy before you.
Yep.
So, I'm waiting for Genghis Khan to be on the ballot in the Republican Party.
And for me, a lot of that relates back to 1964 and the collapse of the Goldwater effort, his embrace of segregationism, which was a 180-degree pivot off of what we saw Eisenhower do as president. And so you had this germination beginning at that time, culminating in the Southern Strategy of 68 with Nixon. And that's just been building ever since. And so this idea now where we find ourselves as a party of accepting seeing children in cages, building walls,
yep.
Tearing down war heroes like John McCain, not wanting to be a part of events because the soldiers who are going to be there don't have arms or limbs, right? Yeah, I mean, and so you sit there, you go, is this really a reflection of America?
No.
Do Americans actually, if I go out on the street and I go up to a citizen who identifies himself as a Trump reporter and I ask them, a supporter, and ask them, do you really believe that John McCain is not a hero? What would their answer be?
I ask people all the time outside of, and I've attended several Trump rallies, and I ask them questions like that. And I've made it, after interviewing many of these people, a lot of them are QAnon supporters, by the way,
don't even get me started on that stupid.
Well, there are a lot of them there. And, you know, you ask, well, here's what about this on COVID or that? And they go,
right.
I don't believe the numbers. Well, what do you mean you don't believe the numbers? They're numbers. I don't believe 1, 2, 3, or 4. I'm partial to 7 for some reason. But the other numbers I don't believe. I mean, what kind of nonsense is that? And when you talk to them, it's almost like you're a Washington football fan, right? You hate the owner, you hate the coach, you hate the team, but you're still cheering for them because, by gum, you already picked your course in life. A lot of them are like that.
Yeah.
I mean, when I come to interview him, it's like, well, yeah, sure, he's full of it. Oh, you know, he's just joking. And that's what they're willing to dismiss the things that Trump does that are bad. And he goes, and they bring up the things that they think are good. Well, he was nice. And do you know him? No, I never met the man. But I'm telling you how it is. I go, well, I do know him and I've interviewed him. But you don't know what you're talking about. That would be like me walking into a surgery table, the guy, you know, doing brain surgery going, look, I know you actually know what you're doing, but I've watched it on TV. So move out of the way. Let me tell you.
Let me do it. And the patient who in this scenario is America is sitting there going, wait a minute, hold on. No. Oh, yeah. I want a real doctor.
And we're willing to take the TV doctor. And part of that is frustrating too, because I've had people tell me, you know, I watched I watched a briefing on TV and this is what happened. I go, I was at the briefing and that's not what happened. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that there's a difference between television and reality.
And that television, that TV reality they're referring to is the one that's created by Fox and the president.
Yeah, the president is a master at that. He tries to create his own reality and he wants the rest of us to live in it. And there are people who are willing to do so. And you asked earlier about how do you stand up against him and how do you, it's like, the best way to put it is I'm descended from a long line of bullshitters. Mm-hmm. My family is filled with lawyers, politicians, and car salesmen.
There you go.
And reporters. So I recognize BS. Donald Trump's BS would not pass muster at my dad's breakfast table.
There
so
you
I'm
go.
Not buying what he's selling. And there are people who willingly do so. And that's and sometimes very bright people.
So right now, we are in the throes, again, this has been an eventful 24, 48 hours in America, given what we were just talking about. But then also in your hometown of Louisville.
Yeah.
With the decision by the attorney general there not to seek, well, the grand jury, not to seek a indictment against the police officers in the killing of Breonna Taylor. Protests, of course, are taking place. And of course, for many, that feeds into the Trumpian narrative about law and order and we'll send someone in there to stop this and all of that. What are your views here? How do you see this?
In Louisville?
Yeah, in Louisville. How do you see this story playing itself out? And what impact does it have in the context of the next 40 days of this election?
Well, I think it's going to have a tremendous impact on the next. It potentially could have a tremendous impact on Mitch McConnell's reelection.
Yeah.
And that he's always enjoyed the ability to win his office because few people vote in Kentucky. Notoriously, few people.
Really?
Vote. There are precincts where there's only a 10% turnout. And those people are always going to be his supporters. They're very, you know,
loyal that way. Yeah, right.
Loyal and fervent. I mean, zealots. But this has that potential to backfire on him. Nationally, what I think it needs to highlight is, look, nothing is more disappointing to me than seeing my home city erupt as it has and seeing those protests and the cops were shot about 2 miles from where Mitch McConnell lives, which is
really,
yeah, which was hilarious. Muhammad Ali walked the same streets as I did. And one of my greatest thrills as a kid was boxing in the Louisville Police Athletic League and getting to meet Muhammad Ali.
Wow.
And he got in the ring with us. And I remember the old Richard Pryor joke about how he was so fast in the ring, he didn't see anything until the fist was coming back. And I was shadow boxing with him, with the champ. And he was like, so pretty, I'm so clean, look at life. I'm gonna put him down on me. And I was like, I'm dead. You know, I'm 9 years old. I don't know, he's not gonna kill me. And one of his punches will give me brain damage. But you know, that's
right.
Yeah, this prior stroke. But he was to grow up in Louisville, I always thought was a little more open-minded. And it's an oasis in a sea of red.
Right.
It was always more more open-minded, and I grew up in a very, I mean, you know, Diane Sawyer is from there, Jerry Abrams. Diane Sawyer grew up down the street from where I grew up.
Wow.
And there's, you know, and how about, and the guy who helped take the Washington Bullets to the title, you know, he was, you know, that he was, went to my high school, Wes Unseld.
Yeah. Wes Unseld, yeah.
His brother, George, was my high school basketball coach. He put me in the game. I averaged more fouls a game than I did points.
Right. Dude, I couldn't even shoot the ball, so we don't even have to go there.
But it's disappointing, and what I hope happens nationally out of it is an understanding that laws have to be changed. One of the most egregious offenses on the books in Kentucky, and it's made by the legislators in Frankfort, not in Louisville, because Louisville doesn't have, you know, a preponderance of legislators. It, you know, they're out in the boonies, and in Lexington and Covington, and so the no-knock warrant's got to go.
Right.
That you can't have a no-knock warrant. And I have a cousin who's a judge there, and she will not sign a no-knock warrant. She tells the cops, no, go do your job first.
Right.
Not
getting right.
A no-knock. And but there are others that have given it, and there's a real lack of understanding that if you shoot somebody and kill them and they're unarmed, even if you're a cop, and I understand the way the law is written, what kind of, you're a cop, you're executing a warrant, and you get fired upon, so you fire back. Okay,
right.
I get that. I do understand that. But the idea that you're able to be there in the first place is where that has to stop.
Right.
And if you don't address that issue, you're going to have other issues of people getting shot and killed that don't deserve. That's why you should follow kind of, I don't know, the rule of law.
Right.
Get a warrant. So that to me is what's got to be addressed.
Yeah. You are a very good journalist, an amazing member of the press corps at a time that there are unfortunately some shrinking violets out there, as you noted, and they have their reasons, God bless them. But as you look at this and everything we've talked about and stuff we didn't even get to, because it's just, we could be here for days talking about it.
Anytime.
I'm looking forward to coming on and just getting asked the question. So
just ask you the question.
what in your view is, what is the elements? What are those things, those intangible, maybe some tangible things that make a good journalist? You fought for your First Amendment rights. You go into that press room every day demanding what is required for a free press. How do you see it? How do you see it coming out? What makes that good journalist in your view, that person, that risk taker, if you will?
When I hire reporters, the first thing I do is when they come to me as you know, young journalists, and for years I ran two community newspapers, the Sentinel newspapers in, you know, Montgomery County.
Right. That's right. That's right.
And I would have reporters, they would come to me and go, well, I think this and this and this. And I go, I don't care what you think. I barely care what I think. What do you know? What can you prove and what do you know?
Right.
Well, I want to write this. I go, when you have 15 years experience, you can write an opinion piece. But until then, go out and find me the facts. So it's got to be insatiably curious. Those make the best reporters. And someone who's willing to take a poke at people that they admire and appreciate, as well as people that they have no respect for, because mm-hmm. it's easy to go investigate somebody you don't like.
Right.
It's a lot harder to investigate somebody that you appreciate and like.
Right.
And that's the mark of a reporter, and that's a mark of a journalist. And then the other part is, I'll go back to Sam and Helen. If you're looking for friends, you know, or as the old saying is, if you're looking for friends, get a dog.
Right.
But don't worry about being part of the in crowd and access. Don't take the opiate. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. When I'm a reporter, I'm not worried about being a friend. I'm worried about being a good reporter.
Yeah.
And that's first. And you're going to get the hate mail and people are going to say, well, you're a libtard. Or then they're going to say, you know, like when Obama was in office and I wrote a column about how he used the Espionage Act 9 times to go after whistleblowers. And I said, that's ridiculous. That's not. And I was told that I was to the right of Fox News. And the greatest compliment I ever got was when I wrote one editorial and I got insulting hate mail from both the left and the right.
There so you go.
I'd angered everybody, done my job.
Well, you're doing your job, my friend, and appreciate the work you're doing over at CNN, especially the work that you're doing as part of the White House correspondents that every day going there representing the American people, the questions we have.
We have to get you to a Playboy party.
This interview was worth everything for that point. He's Brian Karam, award-winning journalist. I think we have a good sense why. Author, speaker, recognized defender of the First Amendment. And check him out on his podcast, Just Ask the Question. You can catch him. What's your Twitter handle?
At Brian Karam.
At Brian Karam. That's K-A-R-E-M, folks.
Stay long.
Brian, thanks so much, man, for coming on. Really, really appreciate it. And looking forward to teaming up on your side of the plane when I get asked the question. All right, folks. Well, that does it for this time together. You know, I always enjoy it. Thank you so much for spending just a few moments with us here at the Michael Steele Podcast. Don't forget to do that download thing at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast on. We love that. Check me out at Michael Steele, at Michael Steele on Twitter. And until next time, stay safe, be well, and wear the damn mask.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.